Welcome to GVN's Talking Comics interview. On today's show, we welcome award-winning comic creator, Jeff Smith. Here's your host, Martin Sexton.
Welcome once again to another edition of GVN's Talking Comics. I'm your host, Martin. And today is one of those days that, actually most days are fun for me, but this one especially, because I'm going to be talking to multiple Eisner Award winner, writer-creator, Jeff Smith, who, of course, was the creator of Bone, which actually is celebrating its 30th anniversary. But that's not all. He's actually has revisited a character that he did previously called Tuki, and he's bringing the character into actually two graphic novels that he's launching for his first Kickstarter. So we're going to be talking about that and the 30th anniversary of Bone, and anything else we can come up with. So let's welcome writer-creator Jeff Smith to GVN's Talking Comics. How's it going, Jeff?
Doing great, Martin. Thanks. Thanks for having me, man.
Well, I appreciate it. Okay, so for the two people probably on our website who don't know who you are, could give me just a little bit of background of what originally got you started in art, and was there somebody whose work that inspired you to kind of think this might be something you might want to do?
It's hard to remember exactly what triggered it, but I do know that I've been obsessed with comics, comic strips, and comic books my entire life. The earliest comic I remember loving was Peanuts. My dad used to read Mad Magazine to me, so I loved, Don Martin and Spy versus Spy. And then when I was like 9 years old or so, I discovered Pogo by Walt Kelly. And that was the first thing I obsessed over. Like, I tried to find Pogo book collections. And I knew on some level that someday I wanted to have my own Pogo books. That's what I called them, Pogo books. Yeah. And I did. That's what my Bone collections eventually were. But that was really the initial, I think, beginning of my obsession with this art form.
All right. Because we've all been going through the whole pandemic thing, I guess I'm going to touch on just a little bit. Matter of fact, I talked to Tom Pyre of Ahoy yesterday, and he said that, of course, I mentioned to him that most of the comic creators that I know handled the pandemic better than most people. And of course, he said mainly because they're used to working from home. So how did you adapt to it? And do you think you gained any kind of thing, anything you can use or learn from this situation?
Well, not to put too much happiness on it, because it was a serious situation. But as you said, cartoonists, especially comic book artists, are used to sheltering in place anyway every day, and for years on end. So, it's just you in a room with just maybe a radio or a stereo or something. That's it. So what really affected me about it was, in a good way, was that it just, you couldn't go out. I mean, I missed my friends, but there was just more time for me to be at the board. So I had set Tuki the webcomic aside for a while for reasons we can talk about later. But when I picked it up was in 2019, and I had begun to expand it and try to smooth it out and make it what I really thought it could be. But it wasn't really till the lockdown when I just had nothing to do except do it. And I expanded it, drew it, inked it, finished it, and then started a second one and finished it. So I did two full-blown Tuki graphic novels in 2020. And if it wasn't for the lockdown, there's no way that.
And so what are the differences between your original web series and your new books?
Well, the original web series, I started immediately after I finished my previous project, which was called Rassel, which is sort of a noirish sci-fi kind of a thing. And I finished that in 2013. And in November of 2013, I announced that I was going to do this web comic, the idea of putting a page up a week. And I had this idea in my head that it would be like doing Flash Gordon or Prince Valiant, right? And then putting it up. But when I collected them later, it didn't flow very well. It was a bit choppy, and more than that, I didn't think the story was as good as it could be. It wasn't really what I pictured. So I set it aside. I said, I'm going to need to redo some of this. I ended up redoing all of it. I mean, I was able to save a lot of the artwork, which I'm really glad that I did some good artwork. My story was just not quite as tight as I wanted it to be. So I was able to rethink the story, reimagine the whole thing, take much of the artwork, repurpose it, adding panels, adding pages. The story starts in a different place and is going a different place. So it's a brand new book, and I'm very happy with it so far.
Now we're starting out with Tookie Fight for Fire. Actually, the whole concept of the idea of, you know, you discover fire and there's a group who thinks that there's something evil about fire and they don't want you to have it, which is actually, to me, it's kind of the way things people are with most things, you know, new things that you discover. You'll find somebody who thinks it's a bad idea. You know, the old, well, if you manage to fly, you should have wings kind of thing.
Exactly.
So this was a great idea.
Thank you. It felt right to me too that the other hominids, the species that don't go on to be us, aren't us. Because I kind of think once we discovered fire, it's us pretty much. But the previous hominids, they make a decision not to adopt fire, and I feel like maybe it was because they were frightened and felt that it was blasphemous. Maybe that you're doing something unclean against nature. And so in my story, the Habilin, the hominids are the other human species that invented the hand axe. They hunt and kill anyone they find using fire. And so that's the situation Tookie finds himself with, these three lost orphan kids that kind of he ends up protecting.
All right. So, I mean, just a little bit I saw of it, because I got to see some of the preview pages. I thought it looked great. Okay, you went black and white. I mean, was that your only choice, or is that just what you had in mind when you first did it?
No, Tookie, ironically, was the first comic I wanted to do. I did, well, my own first creator-owned comic that I actually wanted to do in color from the get-go. But when it came time to rethink it, and I did all this artwork, and the artwork was better than I remembered. It held up without the color quite well. And the real reason was I just was thinking, I want to make a point that this is not the webcomic, and that I'm doing this self-published in the tradition that I had established with Bone and with Rassel. And those were both self-published black and white books. So I thought, this is my third creator-owned project. I'm going to stick with the formula.
So now this is your first time going on Kickstarter, which actually the one thing about Kickstarter I found, especially during this pandemic, is it's been a great way for the creators to kind of connect with fans, you know, as they've been running their campaigns. Of course, you know, without the Comic-Cons, they can't do the actual face-to-face things until everything's opened up. But the Kickstarters have been kind of great for that. And my wife wished I'd stopped putting money into Kickstarter, because I'm going to put us in the poorhouse. So how different is Kickstarter now from when you originally did your first self-publishing?
Well, when I was first self-publishing, it was a very different distribution system in place. There were 11, at least 11 comic book distributors. So there were 11 catalogs that went out every month. And if one distributor didn't want to pick up your new indie book, there were a bunch of others that would. Now, there's only one now, and it's probably a lot easier for retailers to just have the one catalog to try to go through. I think that it's harder now than it was to get something noticed, especially with lockdown, where you can't even go to comic book shows to, like, you know, meet people or show your wares, so to speak. I think now that with Kickstarter with, you know, digital comics, all that kind of stuff, you have a way to show your material. And with Kickstarter especially, and there's other things like Indiegogo, you can now prove that people want to see your book. And that has got to be a step forward and something positive. And retailers will hopefully find it. I mean, all the retailers I know love comics, and they love finding new books for their customers. So I'm very optimistic that this new era is going to work out somehow, especially once we can all get back back into comic book conventions and stuff.
Right. Well, I noticed that on your Kickstarter, you made a special tier just for your retailers, which actually I thought was a kind of a great idea because as you say, it just gives them access to it. And of course, everyone that I've talked to are real excited about the book. I noticed the normal, your tiers that you've got going so far. Do you have anything else additional in mind for later, if it continues to go well?
Yeah. I think we're going to, we only had a few things planned that were, just like adding spot gloss to the cover, upping the quality of the thickness of the paper. We're going to switch it to 80 pound. We're going to move to 15 point covers, just deluxe things that are important to me as a book. But the Kickstarter took off so fast, we blew past all those early things that were going to be stretch goals. So we haven't really hardly talked about them yet. We're working to come up with some new stretch goals, which I was trying, hoping I could have those up today, but it would probably be either this weekend or unless somebody thinks, someone who's done Kickstarter can tell me if it'd be better to wait for Monday or something. We will have some more things. Well, some of it's, little things like a sticker or, little things like that. We have a couple of prints that are really brand new and are going to be fun. We'll do our best.
Yeah, we said, well, I know that actually that has been a common theme with the Kickstarter, especially, they are more successful than they envision, and they didn't plan. It's okay, yeah. So as you said, we burned through all the things. Now what do we do? Because we still got 20 days or 30 days
left. Yeah, we had 22, 23 days or something, and we want to keep the fun up. And oh my goodness, I got to tell you, Martin, I cannot believe the messages we're getting. We're getting the questions, but we're really getting mostly just people writing. And there's this level of happiness. I'm a little overwhelmed by it. I don't know. They're just happy to, that I'm doing another book and that they get to be part of starting it up. And the enthusiasm's just been overwhelming.
I say it's kind of a connection thing, right? You kind of feel like, in some way they are participating in what you're doing. And I understand that completely. Okay, so 30th anniversary of Bone, like I said, geez, wheeze. I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times, but when you started Bone, did you have any clue that it was going to blow up like it has? And 30 years later, some people are still talking about it and buying it.
Yeah. I don't know how that happened. Of course, I didn't picture that at all. In the very beginning, I wasn't even sure if I would get to finish the story. I mean, I had an idea. I didn't know how many years it would take me to do, but I had the story in mind and wanted to do the story really badly and didn't even know if I was going to get to finish it. So let alone that it would take off. And then after I finished it, have a second life with Scholastic and, be in the little Scholastic catalogs and be in Scholastic book fairs. And it almost feels like it's perennial at this point, like it's evergreen. There's a new group of, first, second, third graders coming in, every right. year. And it's incredible. I feel very lucky in a lot of ways. I was in the right place at the right time for a lot of things.
And actually, it's funny because I showed I have a 10-year-old grandson. I showed him a copy of Bone, and he was really interested. But this is the kid that he was carrying a blanket yesterday, and I called him Linus, and he doesn't know who Linus is. He doesn't know Charlie. I said, where have I gone wrong that you don't know who Charlie Brown and Linus are?
I don't know. it just shows you that. It just shows you everything has its time, which is a Mad Magazine is still around, but it's not really Mad Magazine anymore. It's just like a reprint book. That's hard. That's unbelievable that we could exist in a world where Mad Magazine isn't driving satire and humor in some way.
I remember reading Mad Magazine, there's movie satires, and you know, I never saw the movie, but that was the way I learned the plot of the movie, basically, even though there was humor in it, I could still get the idea. Like Chinatown, the first time I ever saw Chinatown was in Mad Magazine.
Right.
And I thought it was hilarious, but I had never seen the film. Okay, so with the 30th anniversary, I know that you're planning on hopefully maybe getting your book out around the same, you know, the actual anniversary time of Bone. Do you have anything else planned for as far as the 30th anniversary for it?
No, not really. I mean, that was it. It was not only the birthday of Bone, but it's the birthday of Cartoon Book, my publishing company that I own with my wife. And we just thought the best way to celebrate it was to drop my third, you know, creator-owned self-published book that month. So that's what we're doing. Right.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure I'll get drunk that day.
Okay. So now from the beginning, did you, I know it's, you know, that you've embraced merchandising. And the reason I bring this up is one of my favorite comic strip artists was Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes. Didn't want anything to do with merchandising. And to be honest with you, I think that was kind of foolish because he could have made a whole lot of money, but apparently that wasn't important to him. Did you ever consider not merchandising Bone?
No. I love that kind of stuff. From when I was a kid on, I really loved three-dimensional renditions of cartoon characters. You know, a really good statue of Bugs Bunny or Mickey Mouse or anything. I've always loved that. And I'm thrilled that there are, you know, little bone toys and bone statues, and they all look really good. It's really important to me that they look good. There's lots of little bone figures. I love it. But you know, I own those characters. The copyrights belong to me. I control everything that happens with them. So maybe that's different for me than it is for Bill. I would have immediately bought a Hobbs stuffed animal. But if he doesn't want to make it, that's his call, man. I'm fine.
I'm pretty much going to call it here. But I got a rhetorical question for you. So if, say you have the opportunity to do a crossover with Bone, with either any comic book character, comic strip character, who do you think Bone would work well with?
With another character, the crossover?
With another character.
If they were back in Boneville and they could just, I think they'd be great with Bugs Bunny. Or with Uncle Scrooge and Donald and the nephews. I think they'd fit right in there. In fact, I'm pretty sure somewhere in Boneville there's a giant money bin right in the middle of town. I'm sure.
That would be pretty cool. All right. So that's pretty much all I got for you today, Jeff. So of course, we're going to be following the Kickstarter, and we'll be promoting it as much as we can.
Everybody, come on out, visit the Kickstarter. We've got some funny stuff. We got some good rewards. We got examples of the pages. So,
Yeah, it's that. More than likely, you're right. I'll probably end up buying a book or two, and I'll fight the wife when that time comes.
Sorry, wife. I'm sorry. Right.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Jeff, and we'll be following closely to what's going on.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Martin. I'll talk to you later.
Right. All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to GVN's Talking Comics. Please come back again. Talking Comics is a production of Geek Vibes Nation.